Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. On November 3rd, 2025, I met with Todd Goddard on Zoom to talk about his biography, Devouring Time, Jim Harrison, A Writer's Life. It was published by Blackstone Publishing on November 4th, 2025. You've written about a writer who lived boldly and very messily. What was it about Harrison's particular life, his wounds and, you know, literal and metaphorical wounds, his appetite for experience, his complicated relationships that made you willing to spend years in such intimate proximity to this guy?
My first thought is everything you just said are reasons why I thought he'd make a fascinating biographical subject because of all those complexities. I read Jim since college. I think I was first introduced to Legends of the Fall when I was at NYU and was immediately hooked and started, you know, seeking out his other books and started reading through his novels and collections of novellas. You know, I became a fan, a sort of deep reader of Harrison for many years. Got a chance to teach him in graduate school, rather, when I got there. In the back of my mind, I'd always been thinking about writing biography. I'd studied under biographers in college and was really always, you know, keeping my eye out for a subject. And I had read that Harrison's papers had been all collected at a place called Grand Valley State University outside Grand Rapids in Michigan, and wasn't quite where I needed to begin a biography at the time. But several years later, I circled back around and was delighted and surprised to find that no one was actually working on it. It was a real organic process for me, really. I sort of just felt it. I knew it was a great subject the first time I saw him. I knew I'd love to write about him. The fact that no one was actually doing it, I thought, was amazing. And so I jumped on the project right away. The things that attracted me to Jim are just what you mentioned, all of his sort of complexities. He's a contradiction of a man, was. He's a sensitive poet, an outdoorsman, fisherman, and hunter, a gourmand, loved food and wine, prolific writer, haunted by the loss of his loved ones when he was in his 20s to a tragic car accident. And I love that he was so multifaceted. I love that he would appeal to so many different audiences. The book's going to be, you know, get a shout out in like Fly Fishing Magazine coming up or Fly Fishing Journal. But he could just as easily be in, you know, the New York Times food section, you know, or the Paris Review for his poetry. And so I loved his multifacetedness. He was in Hollywood, you know, he hung out with Jack Nicholson. He wrote screenplays. His books were turned into movies. So there's that aspect to him. But he wasn't an easy person. You know, he was complex. He was haunted. He was ravaged by depressions and alcohol throughout his life. A remarkably driven and ambitious writer. He was spiritual. And through it all, I think he had retained this remarkable sense of humor, zest for life, a kind of exuberance that I think keeps writers coming back to him again and again. And I think that's what really captured me.
Well, I want to talk about being the first to write about somebody as giant as Jim Harrison. What kinds of pressure have you felt leading up to the publication of this book? Or maybe you don't feel pressure. I kind of want to know what it feels like being the person to define how a significant American writer will be remembered.
You know, the first thing that comes to mind is it's a challenge to map that terrain, right, for the first time. And there were outlines of his life and general sort of big, broad brushstrokes. But, you know, it's really up to you to track down all the details, right, and to create this map of his life. With that, of course, I mean, comes a great responsibility. I mean, I'm not reacting to other biographies in any particular way, right? I'm reacting to conceptions of Jim, popular conceptions of Jim. I'm reacting to his own memoir, which he wrote. I do have works that I'm working against, so to speak, or off of, and that give me a sense of measurement, right? Where am I in relation to how he defined himself and thought of himself and how other, you know, critics and scholars have thought of him. But, you know, there is a sort of responsibility that comes with being that first articulation first interpretation of his life. I have no idea, of course, whether there'll be a second biography of Jim. There certainly could be. He led a big enough life. But I always felt an obligation to his readers. I mean, I always imagined, as I was writing this, his best readers and most sort of devoted readers reading my biography. And I can't say necessarily that I wrote it exactly for them, but close to them. And they were always on my shoulder, sort of overlooking me. I felt a deep responsibility to get it as right as I possibly could. And I felt a responsibility to his family. Many members of his family are still alive, and a lot of his friends are still alive. And so, you know, his memory is fresh in lots of people's minds. And so, yeah, I think you said it correctly. I mean, I think there's a responsibility that comes with the first biography.
You visited quite a few archives, from what I understand. Tell me, to the extent that you followed in his footsteps, to what extent did you exhaust all of the resources that are out there on his life?
In the archive, as any biographer will tell you, of course, I'm reliving, you know, or rereading, and in a sense, thinking about and interpreting every letter he practically ever wrote that's in that archive, and his archives are vast. And so I definitely went down a long sort of paper trail following in his footsteps of all the letters he's written. And we're talking hundreds and hundreds of boxes in his archive. And so I spent close to easily 6 months, maybe not easily, but a solid 6 months at his archive. And I tried to get to as many places as I possibly could were places that meant things to Jim. And for Jim, that's Michigan. That's where he grew up. He was son of a country agricultural agent there, lived in rural Michigan. So I spent time in Lake Leelanau area and visited the towns where he had lived when he was a child, like Reed City and Hazlitt. Went up to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, where Jim had a cabin, and really tried to, you know, do what biographers do, get a sense of the place of this person, right? To be able to learn about the details of that place and get a feeling for it that you can then sort of write into the book, right? And bring people into that place. But for Jim, like someone like Hemingway, he had a lot of places, right? So it kept me traveling. I mean, he fished a lot, kind of sort of famously and infamously, with a cast of characters that included Jimmy Buffett and Tom McGuane in Key West. He lived in a casita in southern Arizona, in Patagonia. He lived in Livingston, Montana. And those are all places he lived and sort of put down roots and had deep connections to. But he also was incredibly popular in France. And so I traveled to France, into Burgundy, and to Marseille and Paris, where Jim spent a lot of time, in Lyon, eating and sort of being feted in Paris because he was so popular in France. And so I'd say I traveled to all those places. I tried to follow in his footsteps as much as I possibly could. I went to Nebraska. Jim had traveled and spent a lot of time in Nebraska, in LA, in New York City, of course. Jim was sort of a regular at the Carlyle Hotel, where Nicholson had a suite, and Jim was close friends with Jack Nicholson. And so I spent a lot of time there. So I really tried to, you know, go everywhere Jim was, but of course that's impossible, right? You can't relive a life and still get a book written. And so I chose the most important spots I could and tried to absorb those places as best I could in the time I had, and, you know, tried to get that sense of place into the biography.
I actually read the first chapter out loud to my husband because it was so funny. You really get a sense of who this person is when he goes to France and he has this 37-course meal. The way you opened this book with this gluttonous scene really gave a window into who this person is. The research for your book must have been such a joy, visiting all these beautiful places and all of that. What were some of the things that surprised you about Harrison the brand versus Harrison the person?
Yeah, one of the things I left out about why I chose this biography is because it was a hell of a lot of fun to write. It's almost always through it. I mean, you know, writing's not always fun, but following in Jim Harrison's footsteps is an endurance marathon, and of usually eating and travel to cool places. And so it was a lot of fun to write. I mean, Jim had this legend. I think he played up in his essays on food and wine and in his journalism, his books of nonfiction, where he had really early on sort of begun creating this larger than life persona of himself. And I don't know that he set out to sort of mythologize himself. He really did do a lot of the things he did, right? He could eat a tremendous amount of food. He thought of it eating as an act of heroism to some extent, and sort of unashamedly, he loved to eat, he loved to drink wine. And I think this attracted a big readership to him. I think people were amazed at the way he wrote about food and wine, about fishing and hunting. He had this sort of exuberance about him. In the process, he cultivated sort of this bigger than life persona. I think a lot of that is true. I mean, Jim was, he could very easily exaggerate stories. He didn't ever feel himself particularly tethered to the facts of any one situation. And so in the 37 course lunch, in retellings of that story to friends and in interviews, he would change the number of wines they drank lots of different times, right? And so he was never particularly tethered to facts. But I mean, does one even need to be tethered to facts when the foundation of that lunch was 37 courses to begin with? I mean, there's already this sort of larger than life foundation. Jim did a lot of the things that he wrote about. He really did eat 37 courses and drink 15 wines with his friends in France. He did eat a half a pound of caviar and a bottle of Stolichnaya with Orson Welles for an appetizer at a restaurant. I mean, just getting started. He did those things. The distinction between the real person and the myth is that there was a lot of pain in Jim's life. He suffered from these deep depressions. He was often not happy. He was often suffering any number of sort of mental health crises that he had throughout his life. And that's the part that gets left out. I think he was out traveling, performing Jim Harrison, performing what people expected of him, which is this larger than life figure with this inexhaustible sense of humor, which he did have. But behind that, often Jim was struggling. He was struggling with vast range of health problems and ailments from really excess related diseases, deep depressions and things like that, that I think I do get at in the book. And those are the parts that Jim sort of masked and left out of the mythology, right? The mythology was this person who could just continue to go on and sort of live heroically, almost like a martyr for everyone else who couldn't quite live the way he lived. But what people missed and never saw were the real physical consequences of those actions, and also just this deep depressions that he'd suffered with since he was a kid, right? Since he was a young teenager.
In the credits of this book, you talk about interviewing over 100 people. I wondered, how did you identify people to interview? And was there a snowball effect, like one person leads to the next person? Or did you have a deliberate strategy for mapping his circles?
I think way led on to way for the book. I think Jim had sort of a core group of friends and obviously family members who are still alive. And so I knew I wanted to get to them. I had a core group. But as as I interviewed core groups, of course, I'm always asking, who would you recommend? Who else might I speak with? Of course, right? And that would lead, way would lead on to way. And it became a sort of vast branch, right? Branching tree of interviews and people. But he did have a core people, Guy de La Valden, who was a French count, was one of his close friends, Tom McGuane, Russell Chatham, the painter, Jack Nicholson, for that matter, who I could not get to for an interview, unfortunately. But, this was a core group of friends that he had, and I knew I needed to get to them.
Fascinating. I mean, he had such an interesting group of friends all across the board, from Anthony Bourdain to,
Dan Gerber,
yes,
who was a poet himself, to
yes, Batali,
Will Hurst, Mario
yes.
Batali, William Randolph Hearst III was a close friend. Gary Snyder was a good friend, the poet Gary.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had this just absolutely vast network of friends that compounded throughout his life.
I want to pivot to your writing process for a second. You have a PhD in literary studies, but you're publishing with a commercial publisher for this book rather than an academic press. How did that shift your writing, and what did you have to do differently to get this book to a commercial audience?
I didn't think Jim would ever fit well with an academic press. He always sort of stood apart from the academy. He didn't make inroads into the academy. He didn't court them. He never really taught, except very briefly, in the late 60s. And I think in turn, the Academy hasn't paid him a lot of attention. He's, not typically anthologized, or and he doesn't have reams of criticism written about him in the way that Philip Roth does, or someone like that. And so I think immediately, I knew right away that this was more of a commercial book. And I thought, and frankly, I thought it was an easier sell to a commercial press than to an academic press. Not that I couldn't have gotten an academic press. I think there were people who were interested, but I think Jim's life lent itself to, a non-specialist academic press. Part of that was his food and wine writing. Part of that was his friends with celebrities. Part of that was his time in Hollywood and his screenwriting, and a sort of very devoted, deep readership of loyal readers and fans who aren't interested in Jim for academic reasons, but because Jim really resonates with them.
The cover image is so captivating. When it came in the mail, actually, I opened the box and I saw this face on the cover. And to be honest, I didn't really know about Jim Harrison outside of his movie, Legends of the Fall. And so I missed out on this person's life completely for whatever reason. But this cover image really sucked me in and got me to open the book immediately. And I started reading it that night that it came into the mail. And then of course there's this insert of photos inside of the book. How did you choose which images to put inside of the book? And then who made that final decision for this cover image?
Two things I knew about this book from very early on. I knew the title almost right away. I knew I wanted to title it Devouring Time, Jim Harrison, A Writer's Life. The Devouring Time comes from a sonnet by Shakespeare, and Jim liked to quote it. And the second thing was the photo. I knew I wanted to include this photo from very, very early on. I wanted it called Devouring Time. I wanted this striking photo of Jim on the cover. I thought they go hand in hand. Jim's face on the cover looks like he's someone who had devoured time. And I had to sort of debate and convince a number of people to put this photo on the cover. Jim's face is my agent and my publisher worried could be off-putting to people because it's sort of, how would you characterize it? It's very extreme. It's what would you say?
There's these deep crevices in his face. His hair is very sparse. I don't know how to describe these like deep crevasses in his forehead. And I don't know, man. It's
He looks
captivating.
like
Like a
Father
sailor,
Time.
like Father Time,
Right.
right?
Here's someone with deep experience and arguably wisdom. And as I was sort of debating this with my publisher and my agent, I was sitting one day in a restaurant with Jim's lifelong agent, a guy named Bob Dottillo. And I was showing him the picture of this picture of Jim on my computer. And I said, Bob, this is the picture I'm committed to putting on the cover of the book. And a group of people saw what was on my computer from like three or four tables away. And literally, the whole table got up and came over and said, "Who is that?" They were compelled to come over and look at this picture of Jim's face. I think it conveys the things I wanted it to convey. It shows experience, wisdom, someone who had devoured time throughout his life. He looks, practically like a supernatural presence on it. The hang up, I think, with the publisher partly was that it might be off-putting to people because it's so sort of rugged and there's nothing pretty per se about him, but it's captivating and magnetic. And the other concern was that he's smoking a cigarette with smoke emanating off his hair, and that some people were concerned about having him smoke on the cover of a book. If you go back and look at pictures of Jim, you're hard pressed to find a picture of him without a cigarette in his mouth. And I conveyed that to them, and I eventually won. And I'm really glad I did because I think it's the one thing people mention immediately. Everybody says, "Wow, right? What a cover!" And that's exactly what I wanted, especially booksellers who want to put it on their shelves and put it in windows. So I absolutely love that. The other photos in the collection in the book, I wanted to try to get the pictures that people hadn't seen, that you couldn't just sort of Google Jim Harrison and see in images, right? And a lot of the family photos in there are photos no one's ever seen. And so I assembled all of these sort of very, what I thought were captivating photos of him as a young young adult, as a teenager, as a child, his family, who he writes about a lot in his poetry. So you get his father, who was one of the people killed in his car accident that affected him so much, and that Jim wrote about for the rest of his life. You get his sister Judy, who was also killed, and who Jim writes about for the rest of his life. And people read those names in his work, but they don't see their faces. And so I really wanted to get their faces in there. I also wanted to touch on this sort of main characters, the people, the persons who peopled his life. And that's Tom McGuane, that's Dan Gerber, Jimmy Buffett, and a number of other people who I thought needed to be represented in here. There's a great picture of Russell Chatham and Jim's agent, Bob Datilla, in France. And a lot of those pictures haven't been seen by readers. And so I wanted to give them something fresh. There are still some iconic photos in there, but I sort of steered away from some of the ones that his readers most know.
Well, he was such a singular man. He died in 2016. Why was this the moment for his biography, and what does Harrison's life and work offer readers in 2025?
I mean, so much, I think. Yeah, I've been thinking about this question a lot, and I was thinking about Rebecca Solnit's remarkable book, Orwell's Roses. She had described the book once as how Orwell's time outside gardening and tending to his rose bushes gave him a sort of reprieve, a sort of time to recreate himself, and gave him the sort of energy to go off into the world and deal with, in Orwell's world, fighting fascism and writing against it. And I thought that applied to Jim a lot. I mean, Jim's poetry, his fiction, his nonfiction are very much anchored to this physical non-human world. And I think that's an incredibly important thing to be reminded of today with the draw of AI and computers and abstractions, that getting into the natural non-human world is a vital source of revitalization for us. And almost all of Jim's works tends in that direction. The other thing, Jim once wrote about fishing. He said he was down in Key West fishing for tarpon, in famously with this group of characters that he hung out with in Key West. And he wrote that he goes tarpon fishing because when you catch a fish, it gives you a jolt of electricity that freshens your feeling for being alive. And I think that applies extremely well to Jim Harrison's writing. I think you can go back to his writing, to his poetry, to his nonfiction, and have a freshened feeling of being alive. Harrison's exuberance is infectious. He reanimates the world in some way and lends to simple pleasures and the world around us, the sort of mundane things of the everyday world. He lends them a sort of a spiritual heft, a sort of reanimated quality to them that does just that, freshens our eyes and our feeling for being alive.
Do you have a piece of writing that's your favorite of Jim Harrison's? Is there anything that somebody coming to Jim Harrison for the first time that you would recommend they read, or an entry point for a new reader?
My entry point was Legends of the Fall, and that's his best known work. And I can't think of a good reason why that shouldn't be a perfectly fine starting point. It's a collection of three novellas. Revenge and Legends of the Fall were both made into movies that might be familiar to people. And I think it's incredibly strong writing and very representative of Harrison's fiction. If people are more inclined to Food and Wine, by all means start with his Food and Wine writing. A Really Big Lunch is the name of his collection of nonfiction writing on food and wine, and The Raw and the Cooked is the second one. And both of those, I mean, you'll immediately be sort of sucked into Jim Harrison's amazing food writing. For his poetry, and so you sort of kind of it's like a buffet. You can kind of pick and choose what you want because Jim was so diverse. But I like In Search of Small Gods. I love The Theory and Practice of Rivers, Saving Daylight. Any of these sort of collections, I think could provide a perfectly great sort of jumping in point for Jim's fiction. Jim's very accessible, and so I don't think you're going to pick up any one of those collections and sort of be off, it'd be off-putting. I think you'll be immediately sucked into it.
I mean, because of this book, I'm a new fan. I'm buying a collection of his poetry. Many biographers say that their first biography either cures them or hooks them, right? Which is it for you? Is there like another life calling for you, or are you content to have finished this particular obsession? Are you planning another biography? What's next?
Great question. It's definitely the latter. I'm hooked on biography, partly because I just spent a lot of time sort of trying to figure out how to write one and reading lots of other biographies as I've been doing for a long time. And I want to have another go at it. But I'm also just hooked on the genre, the form. I love the, I love burrowing into a life that I find fascinating, for the same reasons that I like reading them. And so I'm definitely going to write a second biography. I don't have a subject yet definitively decided. I'm sort of circling a few topics, and I'm looking forward to landing on one, when all those factors sort of just come perfectly together. And I'm like, yes, this subject. But I have a few that I'm looking at very carefully. And, I'm hoping to get started in the next couple months. I think everyone in my life thinks that I'm absolutely crazy for doing that. But of course, I think all biographers could say the same thing.
Well, thank you so much.
Jenny, thank you so much. It's a real honor to be on this podcast with you. Thank you so much for the invitation.
That was Todd Goddard talking with me about his book, Devouring Time, Jim Harrison, A Writer's Life, which was published by Blackstone Publishing on November 4th, 2025. This interview was recorded on Zoom on November 3rd, 2025. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member and producer Jenny Skoog in New York City. Sonia Williams is our executive producer. Darren Nesblid created our theme music. Until next time, thanks for listening.